cotton bowstring, answered the master, like a little child holding the proffered finger. It grips so firmly that one marvels at the strength of the tiny fist, and when it lets the finger go, there is not the slightest jerk. Do you know why? Because the child doesn't think, I will now let go of the finger to grasp this other thing. Completely unself-consciously, without purpose, it turns from one to the other. And we would say that it was playing with things, were it not equally true that the things were playing with the child. Eugen Herrigel. The Gracie family is the first family of mixed martial arts. Their contribution to the sport is nothing short of fundamental. In post-colonial Rio de Janeiro, the vibrant maize city that hung like a jewel of water on a spider web between the deep blue sea and the green jungle, a Brazilian politician and businessman of Scottish descent, Gastão Gracie, befriended a wandering professional fighter and Japanese judoka master, Mitsuya Maeda, in 1917. Gastão helped Maeda do business in Rio. In return, Maeda agreed to instruct Gastão's eldest boy, Carlos. Carlos and his brothers embraced and reinvented what they'd learned, and since the 1920s, they fostered an atmosphere of innovation and real-world combat in Rio. They challenged any and all comers, and nearly always won in the Vale Tudo. Anything goes matches. The philosophy of Arte Suave, constant innovation and relentless testing, all on the ground, made for a revolution in the fighting world. Brazil is a modern nation of frozen colonial power structures and wealth disparity. The Portuguese came to steal, exploit, and find gold to take home, not build a nation. And Brazil still suffers from those rapacious intentions woven into the cloth of her identity. In some ways, Brazil lags behind today's world by a full century. In others, it is inescapably modern, educated, moneyed. The nature of jiu-jitsu reflects the dualities of scientific technique combining with old-school Latin American machismo, a need to fight to prove who is the toughest, along with another Brazilian trait, the love of play. While Royce, pronounced Royce as all R sounds are H in Portuguese, Gracie was the standard bearer for jiu-jitsu. Chosen by the forward-looking Horian Gracie to lead the way in the initial UFCs and showcase the family's art, and Hickson is the legend, the undefeated greatest who lives shrouded in mystery. To me, the truly greatest Gracie is a younger cousin, Henzo, yes, Henzo, who fought anyone, anywhere, and took his losses and his wins with equal aplomb. Henzo seemed apart from the convoluted family politics. He put himself out there, and he embodied what the Gracies claimed to be about. He fought anyone, anytime. When you step back and look at his fighting career as a whole, Henzo is probably underrated. In the beginning, when Royce won the UFC, not many people were aware of what he was doing. He was armbarring fighters who didn't know the danger they were in. The legendary Hickson has always been criticized for not fighting the best available, but, in truth, being a generation older, he came up at a time when there wasn't as much competition, especially outside of Brazil. Hickson was retiring as international MMA blossomed. Henzo consistently puts his money where his mouth is, and he fought with the best he could find. He fought and beat much bigger guys, and not clueless boxers, but seasoned mixed martial artists such as Maury Smith, 235 pounds, Oleg Taktarov, 210 pounds, and the like, most of whom outweighed him significantly and knew his game. His natural fighting weight would have been 155, and he was fighting heavyweights, good heavyweights, for the time. It's unimaginable now. What I also love about Henzo is that he kept doing it, even through losing fights to bigger fighters like Sakuraba or Dan Henderson. Royce and Hickson seemed protective of their legacies, but Henzo was never precious about his. He would risk it, and himself, at the drop of a hat. In his last three fights, Henzo has beaten three former UFC champions, Pat Miletic, Carlos Newton, and Frank Shamrock. Henzo was never a muscular freak of an athlete, but a normal guy with a head of thick black curly hair and an open, honest face. His stand-up wasn't his strength, but it was effective, and he was a fighter. He'd force opponents to respect his hands, just a little. His ground game was superlative. To this day, in the twilight of his career, he still has to be considered one of the best in the world on the ground, and an elite-level fighter. For despite the sport's quantum growth, he has grown with it. Henzo still sometimes throws in his hat at Abu Dhabi, one of the very few MMA guys who will compete in pure grappling competitions. Henzo has done it all with an incredible lightness of spirit, a human warmth and ease that makes him one of the best on-camera interviews in the business, and one of the great teachers and most respected men in the fighting world. Henzo was born into fighting. Fighting was the family business. His brothers and cousins and fathers and uncles were all dedicated to jiu-jitsu. The Gracie family had decided to go that way, to make their bones in that world as a family. Henzo makes it clear that it wasn't forced, that nobody had to do anything they hated. We all grew up like champions, eating right, thinking right. We were built and forged to be the best. But everything came very naturally. We were never forced to fight. It surrounded us. Everything began as play. We spent time as kids at the academy. My brothers, cousins, everyone. Many in the family don't follow fighting as a profession, but they are still very strong-minded. The Gracie family is huge, and not everyone fights professionally, but almost everyone has logged some mat time. You start seeing your relatives, the people you love and admire, involved in jiu-jitsu, and so you end up embracing that. It becomes a way of life. And then, of course, you want to excel and be the best. It comes naturally. And the way jiu-jitsu is, you want to win. You start to know that to be second place is just to be the first loser. That appetite is such a big part of the game. Henzo sometimes seems a man out of time. There's something about him of the 19th century gentleman, to whom honor and respect are far more important than life and limb. Something about the feudalism of Rio and the nature of what he does. Brazil in the 1970s, when he was a boy, was still governed by colonial ethics, with the remnants of the Portuguese Romanticism. There's a great new documentary film called Legacy, made by Gethin Aldous, about Henzo. And in it, Henzo's brilliant loquaciousness is on full display. Bon mot following bon mot. Henzo talks about his father, Hobson, also a jiu-jitsu maestria, who at one point took to the streets in an attempt to change things for the better and nearly lost his life. The Gracie family name saved him. Hobson was obviously another iconoclast in this family of warrior monks. All of these factors combine to make Henzo a more unique individual than even he realizes. I came to New York to talk to Henzo and hung around his school until he showed up. "Meet me at 6," he said, and showed promptly at 10. Classic Carioca, the slang in Brazil for someone who lives in Rio, where punctuality is not a virtue. But once I got hold of him, Henzo understood what I was after and showed me why he was the most fun interview in MMA. The next day, I drove out to his house, where he made me welcome. Henzo laments the rudeness in America, even while he agrees it makes life simpler, the hermetic modern life where you never acknowledge anyone you don't know. Back in Rio, on the beach, I used to fight 3 or 4 times a day, and no one really held a grudge. The police would just send you home, maybe yell at whoever started it. But here, everything is so serious. A guy insulted my wife and kids at a gas station. Here the mind reels. And I went over to talk to him, to get him to apologize. And so he insulted me, and I slapped him. He throws himself on the floor, crying for the police, says his neck is hurt. I had to go to court 5 times, pay $1,500, all for this damn slap we do harder every day in practice. He pauses and shrugs, then says with a hint of melancholy, "Life here is simpler. You don't waste time saying hello to everybody." Respect, the essence of the fight game, was a huge part of Henzo's growing up. My father, my grandfather, I respect them so much I am very quiet around them. I wanted to make sure that anything that came out of my mouth made sense. I idolized them, but I saw they were human too. Henzo's father, Carlson's brother, was an integral part of the family and eventually president of the Federation of Jiu-Jitsu in Rio. I recently realized how important my father was, because he was always telling me that the impossible is nothing. Even though I was extremely weak physically and small, he would always tell me that I was so smart and technical that without time limits, I could finish anyone in the world. The old Valetudo fights were often fought without time limits, as that was closer to a real fight. The Gracie style could be played in a safe, defensive, relentless way that would eventually yield a choke or submission, given enough time. Fighting without time limits is something they miss. Henzo laughed hard, something he did about every third sentence, with a face like a cherub. His heavy Brazilian accent is iconic. It's not only his accent, but the rhythm and variations in tone that are so signature Brazilian jiu-jitsu, my friend. He's almost cartoonishly animated, his eyes flaring wide, eyebrows reaching for the heavens. Now, that wasn't true back then. When I fought good guys who were big, they could give me trouble. But my father was always placing little pearls in my brain, and I believed him. Henzo grew up in the perfect environment in which to groom a fighter, and he fell deeply in love with jiu-jitsu and with competition. He would be a warm-up to best guys as a kid. His confidence grew. By the time he was a man, he knew as much jiu-jitsu as anybody in the world, with the possible exception of Hickson. Every time I step in the ring or onto the mat, I always feel that there is nobody that knows this better than I do. It's not a magic box. There's no surprise for me, no situations or positions that I can't understand. So I'm very relaxed for fights. I even fall asleep before fights. A few times, in Pride, I bring a pillow from the hotel, and they have to wake me up to get me to warm up. He finds that hilarious. Henzo's career is unique. He is astride the transition of MMA. He fought in Brazil in the old days, in the Valetudo. He fought in Japan in Pride, in front of 40,000 fans, and he fought for the UFC, for the IFL, for Elite XC. He's outlasted most of these promotions. He shrugs when he thinks about it. It's been an unbelievable ride up to now, he says. Early in his career, Henzo had come to America. He wanted to teach in New York, and he struggled. He was doing okay, but was having problems with his native partner. My worries had a base, because in the end, he kicked me out of the country. He tried to call immigration on me, and my visa was under him. It was a mess. I had to go home with my tail between my legs. That's one thing when you're alone, but another thing when you have a wife and three kids. He needed money and took some fights. First, Eugenio Tadeo, a Luta Livre star. And then, 2 weeks later, Henzo was fighting in Japan. So I fight, jump in a plane, and then fight Akira Shoji at Pride 1. I needed the money. I give it straight to the lawyers and split from that partner and get my green card. He glosses over it blithely, but I press him. I know about the Tadeo fight, one of the last famous Valetudo matches. Luta Livre basically means wrestling in Portuguese, and it was the name taken by Gracie students who split off from the family and the gi, often poorer guys from the favela in Rio who couldn't afford the gi. They wrestled and grappled no gi, and fought Valetudo, and of course had a deep and undying enmity with the Gracies. I used this opportunity to ask Henzo about the age-old question, gi or no gi? MMA fights are not allowed with the gi on, so it is better to train without one all the time. Or for jiu-jitsu, do you need to practice with it? Greg Jackson's guys have high-level jiu-jitsu, and they never train with it. Eddie Bravo threw away the gi, but still wears the gi pants. And let me just say this, rolling in gi pants is not no gi. Usually, the answer is pretty standard. The wrestlers feel like you don't need it, and the guys who come from traditional jiu-jitsu feel it's important. Henzo's take was interesting. If you want to be a really good grappler, you have to learn with the gi. With the gi on, everything is so much harder, 100 times harder. With no gi, you take a good wrestler and in 3 months he understands where the danger comes from and his game will be fine. The moment you put on a gi, the opponent has handles to grip, so everything is much harder. Harder to pass guard, to defend guard. So it teaches your hips to be extremely active to get out of the way. What I see in MMA now is a lot of guys go straight to no gi and then MMA. So their guard is a joke. Poja, I've been on the bottom in every fight that I did, and I never get hit. You see BJ Penn, he never takes damage on the bottom, and he trains in the gi all the time. He comes from my brother's school. I see these other guys go in there and lock their legs, but they get hit the whole time they're in guard. When you train in the gi, your hips are better, sweeps are better, your escape from the mount is 10 times better. With a gi on, the mounted guy has 100 attacks, and without it, he has 2 or 3. It's a joke. In Brazil, the Luta Livre guys trained with us for a while. They were purple belts when they separated off and stopped training in the gi. They were big guys, taking steroids. They were tough and strong-minded, but we never lose to them. We beat the shit out of them. And we trained gi all the time, and only no gi right before the fight. Henzo was fighting Eugenio Tadio in Rio, in one of the last Vale Tudo fights without gloves, pure old school. I took the fight on last-minute notice, and the money wasn't good, but I had to pay lawyers in New York. I just wanted to make sure that the floor was canvas, because I knew he was going to come full of oil. Whatever his body touched on the mat, I couldn't stand on it. Henzo means Eugenio would be greased up, making him much harder to submit. The Luta Livre guys and the Gracie family had a long feud and had met many times before in Vale Tudo matches and in formal fights on the beach that could turn epic. It was an interesting match because I always dislike him, his attitude, his way of being. He was always with the wrong crowd, surrounded by criminals and drug dealers. I was always on the police side. I train a lot of police. I was on the sports side. He was always playing the role of being from the ghetto. So it was an important fight for me, because I don't like him. You can see the class difference coming out. The Gracies had long trained only the upper echelons of Rio society. My only pleasure in that fight was going to be to punch him in the face, because I knew right away he was completely greased up and hell to hold on to, like trying to hold a fish. This was a grudge match, and the Luta Livre guys had been filling up the arena for hours. They'd come in early and taken all the seats around the cage. And here, the danger of Rio and Brazil starts to appear. It's not that all Rio is so dangerous. In Ipanema, little old ladies walk on the street at night. But it is a place where shit can go wrong. Really wrong. Now his people had invaded the event. He brought 200 guys with guns and knives, and they surrounded the cage. Even before our fight, they wouldn't let nobody get close. We were afraid of a riot. So we sent our guys up into the stands. When I walked out, I saw the cage was surrounded by Luta Livre guys. There were no jiu-jitsu guys except my brother and a couple of others. When both fighters were in the cage, they fell into a long Wild West gunslinger stare down. Both men frozen and staring across the ring for minutes. Totally still. Watching it, you can almost hear the theme song from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. When the fight began, Henzo was having some success early on. He even took Eugenio's back a few times, but couldn't keep him down. Henzo started to look for a little ground and pound, as he couldn't get any submissions going. I took him down, and every time I put my head against the fence, to keep him pinned down, they kicked me through the fence. Someone cut me with a knife or maybe some keys through the fence. Not deep, but it was a mess. Henzo was bleeding from his shoulder. The Luta Livre guys were swarming outside the cage following the action, scuffling with the cameramen and ringside officials. Whenever Henzo and Eugenio got close to the edge, the sides of the cage pulsed with screams and insults. I started seeing the guys outside the cage doing it. One time, when the ref separates us, I see one of them hanging with his body half inside the cage, talking shit. So I'm looking at Eugenio, and I move a little and get close, and then I land a straight shot right to the middle of the forehead of the guy outside the cage. He fell down and my brother kicked him in the face. So then, the riot starts. Henzo laughs. It was such a mess. The lights ended up falling into the ring. I started to feel this intense heat and I looked up to see the big lights have fallen into the cage. And people are screaming to turn the lights off because it's gonna set the place on fire. As the lights go out, they pull out guns. They're shooting all over the place. Henzo was bored with this story. It was a big mess. Then, 2 weeks later, Henzo flew to Japan to fight Akira Shoji in the inaugural Pride show. I was still purple with bruises and cuts. It ended as a draw, this being the early days of Pride without clear scoring. I asked Henzo if these were his toughest fights. He declined to answer, in a completely sincere way. I could feel what he was thinking. Fights that are in the past aren't tough anymore. Who cares about those fights? Always I think the toughest one is the next one. Every fight is tough, a surprise box. You never know what's gonna happen. Victory is certain, and then you have your arm broken with 17 seconds left. Like the Sakuraba fight. I was thinking that fight was mine, all I need to do is manage the time. And then I lost. Henzo fought an epic battle with Kazushi Sakuraba, who is a Japanese fighter and one of the all-time greats. Sakuraba was a natural 185-pounder, and much bigger than Henzo, and they had one of the standout, fantastic MMA fights in history. The fight ended with Henzo's arm horrifically dislocated in a kimura, but with Henzo staring calmly, not tapping, hoping to continue. And there are fights when everything seemed lost, and I won. The toughest is always the next, because the other ones fade in my memory. I have to watch tapes because I can't believe I did this, it's so funny. Even my record, I have to check to see who I beat. But the ones I lost, those I always remember. I know exactly what happened. That's the difference. With my students, I always tell them that the loss is where you can get better. Once you make a mistake in a fight or competition, you never do that again. It's burned in your brain. See those mistakes and cover those holes. That's why you learn more when you lose than when you win. When you win, you forget. What is a champion but a guy that didn't quit? I always try to tell them there's nothing better than a day after another. Life is a continuous experience. You only fail by not learning. For jiu-jitsu, the smarter you are, the better you understand the leverage and positions and the middle. For instance, my head instructor is John Danaher, and he was a philosophy teacher at Columbia. He's a smart guy. Danaher, or New Zealand John as he's sometimes referred to, being a Kiwi, is the head professor at Henzo's Academy. He has a PhD in philosophy from Columbia, and did, in fact, teach there. Henzo said, "He was one of my first students here, and I was able to bring him out of everything he believed in and get him into jiu-jitsu. It was one of the best things I've ever done." I had heard about John, that he was the real genius at Henzo's, a master of jiu-jitsu, an innovator who never competed, a guy who was quietly changing the game with his private lessons. George St. Pierre and other notables took private lessons with him. Real guys knew what was up. Danaher was an open secret. Henzo said that, even now, when he had questions about a move, he'd go talk to John first. Jiu-jitsu is a dialogue. New Zealand John is a fine-featured man with a pale, narrow face, longish hair, a bald spot like a tonsure, and a muscular build. He has a deformed knee, a result of a childhood surgery gone wrong. He's so quiet and soft-spoken, I practically had to put my ear to his mouth to hear what he was saying, sitting next to him on the mat. He's articulate in his murmuring Kiwi accent, and you don't want to miss a word he says. John had come to the United States at 24 years old and gone to Columbia for his graduate degree. To supplement his income, he'd worked as a bouncer. He'd been a gym rat and studied Muay Thai in New Zealand, although his bum leg had limited his style to the clinch. He'd come to be Henzo's student the usual way, by word of mouth. He hadn't been a natural, or taken strongly to jiu-jitsu. With a wry smile, John said, "I had an undistinguished entry into the sport." But when two of Henzo's top instructors left to form their own schools, he was asked to step up and teach. At that point, he began to take it seriously, and it took over his life. When I asked him about his take on the mental game in jiu-jitsu, he turned professional. The two most misused words in the English language are mental and spiritual. You hear people use the words so sloppily, with such an ill-defined manner, it's unclear what you mean. John had studied and taught epistemology, questions about the nature of knowledge. He was concerned with semantics, specifically knowledge as opposed to belief. He wasn't going to let me skate on some vague questions. I sweated and babbled, and eventually John took pity on me and helped me out. I see two things that fighters deal with, two emotions that create weakness, fear and anger. And for the first, it's not fear of injury. The idea of failing in front of a great crowd is massively harmful to us, as such social creatures. I recalled how David Horton would tell everyone he knew that he was going to run the Appalachian Trail, or Pacific Crest Trail, because that added social pressure helped him continue. Anger just makes people inefficient. Their breathing gets shallow. They're too muscularly tense. They gas faster. Part of what I admire in a fighter like Marcelo Garcia is his ability to control his anger and stay focused. He often gets abused physically. He's a smaller guy in the open weight competitions, but you never see him distracted. He's like a laser, focused on finishing. He has one physical cold goal in mind, and nothing distracts him. The abuse is irrelevant. Anger can take you away from your goal. You can get caught up in a desire for revenge, which distracts you. Experienced fighters will create this in opponents. To John, what sets the top guys apart is the idea of relaxed poise. The single definitive feature of the uber athlete is a sense of effortlessness in a world where most men grunt and strive and scream. It comes easy to the best. And what creates that? I think it's a sense of play. No fear or anxiety about their performance. Like when the first time you ever drove a car, you came out sweating and exhausted. Now when you drive a car, it's effortless and smooth. Fear and anger are motor inhibitors. Danaher reflects on his teacher. Henzo has no fear of fights. He doesn't see them as serious events. He can't get mounted and pounded out. He may lose, but he won't get smashed. There goes the gravity of the situation for him. When I ask Henzo about Danaher, he gushes. He's completely unconventional, unpredictable, but he does jiu-jitsu the way I learned it. Nothing matters but finishing. Position is just a way to get to the finish. His mind is good, and one of the most important things to teach is your own mind. If I just show you 10 moves, you'll never do them like I do them. But if I show you why I get there and how I think, then it's better for you. And, almost more important, if I teach it the right way, then I have it pure in my mind. Henzo fell silent, ruminating on that. The most important part of jiu-jitsu is the middle of the way. It's the path between one position and another, the transition, that makes the difference between a mediocre fighter and an unbelievable fighter. A bruiser, a guy who is just headbanging and pushing his way through, it stops when he meets someone stronger. And for every 10 victories, he'll have 10 defeats. But when you have an understanding of the middle of the way, the ability to think and to see, your situation will get better. I was instantly reminded of Marcelo Garcia and what everyone always said about him. He was a master of the transition. He lived in the middle of the way. Henzo liked Marcelo's game because he's trying to finish all the time. The beauty of Marcelo is that he developed such good defense, being the little guy at the academy, that he brushes off all finishing attempts on him. He's so efficient and focused on the finish. It's pure jiu-jitsu. I realize now that my jiu-jitsu is much simpler than when I was a purple belt. When I was a purple belt, I tried the most amazing moves. I ran a marathon to get 5 miles away. Now, everything is much clearer. You don't waste time or strength. You just go straight to the point. I used to see this on Hickson a lot. His jiu-jitsu is very simple. He just goes straight for the finish. Even though everyone knows what he's trying to do, nobody could stop him. He's very simple, with direct moves and objectives. He'll go right there and get you right there. Even though you knew what was happening, his precision and his tightness were so good that you couldn't stop him. The better you get, the simpler everything gets. I always knew that nobody could control the situation better than I could, so that made me extremely confident. And nobody can make me give up. I remember a 51-minute fight in Japan. The guy outweighed me by 30 kilos. And I thought, I'm going to be here all night. If I can't finish him, we'll be here tomorrow morning. Because I don't give a fuck, I'm not giving up. I'm going to see how he's going to make me quit. It's impossible. The words are ordinary, but when Henzo says them, they are moving, because he lives and dies with them. I think the jiu-jitsu mentality gives you that. From a young age, we go, we believe that if we go until one of us quits, it's never going to be me. He's almost shouting at me. I could never see myself being beaten. I could never ask for water, never ask for the bill. He laughs. I could never be the one. If he's tired, let him ask for the check. I remember Sean Williams, one of Henzo's students, who I studied under in L.A., telling a story about Henzo playing a video game. It was a game that Henzo had never played before, but he had it set at the hardest level. That's when he was having the most fun, said Sean. Henzo continues quietly. The mentality is from my grandfather, my father. But really, it's the jiu-jitsu mentality, and probably goes back to Maeda, his master. It's the soul of jiu-jitsu. Like that famous picture of a little cat looking in the mirror, but he sees a lion on the other side. Henzo sees the lion, believes it, makes it true. Down the Rabbit Hole. A quote used in my first book would often drift into my mind, wonderfully eloquent. These are forces played out on the physical stage. The raised white canvas is a blank and basic platea, which makes it possible to see great fighters as great artists, however terrible their symbolic systems. It may be, and perhaps should be, difficult to accept the notion that a prize fighter's work merits the same kind of attention we lavish on an artist's. But once we begin attending to and describing what he does in the ring, it becomes increasingly difficult to refuse the expenditure. The fighter creates a style in a world of risk and opportunity. His disciplined body assumes the essential postures of the mind, aggressive and defensive, elusively graceful with its shifts of direction, or struggling with all its stylistic resources against a resistant, but, until the very end, alterable reality. A great fighter redefines the possible. It's from an essay by Ronald LaVeo in a book called Reading the Fights. I have always found the lines to be uniquely moving, and they seem particularly relevant to this project. I think we can and should consider great fighters as artists. We do, to belabor an obvious point, call it martial arts. Here we come to a fundamental question. Is it interesting to talk to artists about how they think about art? Is there anything to be learned? I have some unfortunate history with this question. I was an art major at Harvard, and I had a somewhat adversarial relationship with the department. The central dissension, I thought, I had with my professors, was about language and art. Simply put, I felt that art is visual and language is not, and so talking about art is something of a waste of time. Certainly talking about how artists think wasn't important. What matters is their work. I didn't care about the history of a painter, or what tradition he's refuting with subtle accuracy. Does his painting, does the picture on the wall, knock my socks off? If so, great. If not, who cares what he intended? Well, I was an arrogant, callow youth. For now, I find myself doing just that. Discussing artists and how they think. Strangely, upon revisiting, I found that one of those same professors agreed with me the whole time. Maybe I was just a bad painter. I tracked down Peter Sheldahl, an art critic who had served a brief stint as my professor. Sheldahl has written for The New Yorker, Art News, and The New York Times. His criticism has won awards. He'd been around the art scene in New York since the 1960s and known Andy Warhol and everybody else. David Sally, a painter, said of Peter, "He has a formidable ability to cast into lively prose the paradoxes and conundrums of looking at art." And his biggest influence was Red Smith, one of the great sports writers of all time. Peter and I had had a rocky relationship in college. I had been an admirer of his, and he had thoroughly savaged me in my final critique. But the past was past. I was over it, and I was curious to hear what he would say about this line of reasoning. Could talking to artists about how they think possibly be useful? I finally caught up with Peter in Manhattan, at a cafe in the East Village. As I walked down the crowded streets to meet him, I reflected on the changes. In the heyday of the New York art scene, the Lower East Side neighborhoods were filled with old tenement buildings where artists hung out with poets. Peter had originally been a beat poet. Now it was the retail version of that. Punks with faux hawks and dirty clothing pushing shining bikes with solid disc wheels that cost $2,000 or $3,000. I looked around for a real punk who might steal the kid's bike after stomping his face with a Doc Marten. No luck. Those days are gone for Manhattan. Now the prevailing feeling on the city streets is that everyone is wealthier than you. Peter showed up much older, still vital, bemused by the changes around him. A refugee from the past, a stone in a whirlwind, New York was still New York to him. He had a hard time at first with the nature of my question. Is it worthwhile to discuss how artists think? He parroted my question, frowning. I don't know. I know when artists work, they don't think. It's a different setting in the mind. The purer the art, the less they have to say. We talked for a while, but to little effect. We parted amicably and agreed as writers that we should write each other about it. And so we began a correspondence of ideas. In each significant case, he wrote, discussing how artists might talk about how they think, the answer will be idiosyncratically specific and, to us ordinary mortals, wondrously incomprehensible. It may seem scandalously dopey. Our tendency is to think, when our only hope is to not think. We get consumed with wanting to win or to do well, and forget just to make the art or hit the ball. As a baseball nut, I have this constant fascination with the incredibly complicated task of seeing, assessing, and solidly hitting on exactly the right square inch of a round bat, a 97-mile-per-hour fastball over a time span of far less than a second. It's amusing to read Ted Williams on hitting. He said he could see the ball compressing against his bat. He said he could smell the bat wood burn. I think that when we do a thing right, we feel joy, but an impersonal joy, not belonging to us. An example of personal joy is the joy of winning, which any true master will hold in contempt. Considerations of success or failure don't enter the mind of a master when the chips are down. Some artist, Peter thought it was maybe Philip Guston, said that when you start to work, every artist you ever cared about is in the studio with you. One by one, they leave. Finally, you leave too. Then the work happens. I had a book of Peter's, a collection of interviews with David Sally, a painter who had become famous in the 1980s with his figurative work, rife with symbols, juxtaposing images from a wide variety of sources. He was a bona fide famous painter. Peter recalled meeting Sally in 1980. Fascination and suspicion, even fear, attended rumors of his enigmatic work. Underground prestige and commercial success. I had seen a few of his pictures, with their bluntly drawn erotic and melodramatic images on fields of acrid color, and had been at first jarred, then baffled, then increasingly stirred by them. They were like ready-made dreams, as intimate as if I had dreamed them myself, and utterly fresh. I had a similar reaction to Sally's work. I can paint better than that, was my first thought. But, like very few paintings, they continue to get more interesting and beautiful the longer you examine them. The more you look, the better they appear, and they become transcendent. With the help of my friend and agent David Kuhn, I managed to track down Mr. Sally and spoke with him over the phone. As well as being one of the major figurative painters of his era, he designed sets for theater and ballet and had an appreciation for the kinesthetic. He'd even dabbled in boxing and knew the frenetic pace of early sparring sessions. What sets painting apart from other kinds of art making is that it's performative. In the moment, did you do it well or not? He said over the phone from his studio in New York. That was a shocking statement to me, because it was so obvious, yet I hadn't considered it. Of course, the athletic stroke of the painter is frozen in time for all eternity to witness. Sure, you can paint over it. But then that new stroke is the one we see. That new gesture. It's still frozen for all time, the minute you let it alone. The moment it's considered done. Some painters feverishly rework and repaint the canvas, trying to get it right. But they still have to get it right and then leave it. Just like a video record of a fight. You got knocked out, and we can watch it for eternity. There's no such thing as conceptual boxing or conceptual football. Either you complete the pass or you don't. Painting is obviously so much more than technique or brushwork. Whatever it is, whatever mental, spiritual, or emotional thing you're bringing to bear, it's all expressed by the point of the brush, the paint left behind. It's bizarre how specific it is, like being a stunt pilot. What I try to do is a paradox, by consciously getting outside myself. It's hard to do with the consciousness, but the best paintings. One has a feeling that you don't know where they came from, they just happen. I always say that students need to get out of their own way. We're living through an intensely mental phase in the history of art. The scales often tip one way or the other, and right now, they've gone into this extreme mental state and cognitive direction. But it's not always like this. The way art has been taught in the last 30 years is all about intentionality. And I would say intentionality is overrated. So there, I thought with some satisfaction. I don't really give a shit what somebody thinks their work is about. Students are expected to talk about intentions, and I think, who cares? I don't even want to know, don't tell me. Sally trailed off. Sheldahl had pointed out an article in a recent New Yorker called The Eureka Hunt by Jonah Lehrer. The New Yorker, July 28, 2008. It's a fascinating essay on the brain science behind insight. The title comes from the shout, Eureka, Greek for I have found it, when you suddenly realize the truth, the solution, and details the scientific pursuit for the location and source of insight, chemically and electrically, in the brain. Mr. Lehrer endeared himself to me right off the bat by using the Mann Gulch fire as his lead-in. Mann Gulch was a famous tragedy wildfire in 1949 that killed 13 smoke jumpers. I was a wildland firefighter for 2 seasons, and this was a fire that every firefighter has studied, because it was an example of the first ever burnout. A group of 16 smoke jumpers were hiking along about mid-slope, flanking a fire on the far side of the valley. On the opposing wall. Then fire got in below them, on their side. Fire below you is death. If you light a match and hold it with a flaming end up, it will burn slowly down the match. Fire burns down slowly. If instead you turn the match at a steep angle, with the flaming ends down, then it will burn up to your fingers in a few seconds. Fire moves uphill at incredible, explosive speeds. And the smoke and hot gases precede the flames. The crew was trapped, the fire racing up the slopes through the tall, dry brush, pushing a wall of flame toward them. Their only hope was to try and outrun it, get over the top of the hill, a losing race. Men sprint uphill at 4 or maybe 5 miles per hour, while fire moves at 20 or more. The steeper the hill, the slower the men and the faster the fire. Then the foreman, Wag Dodge, had a flash of insight. The finger of God stroked his brain. He lit his own fire and lay down in the ashes. He called for his men to join him, but they didn't understand what he had intuitively known. Fire won't burn where it's already burned. This was the first intentional burnout, something that would later become the standard strategy of sorts for firefighters. We'd call it bringing the black with you. But Dodge's men didn't know him, and didn't trust him, and couldn't hear him over the roar. His men ran, and 13 of them died. Wag lived. Norman MacLean wrote a beautiful book about it called Young Men and Fire. Mr. Lehrer's article was about the cognitive action of insight, about where in the brain the activity took place, and what that told us about flashes of genius. He chronicles the scientists mapping the brain first with MRIs, and then with EEGs, hats covered in electrodes. While test subjects racked their minds for answers, The scientists watched. When Insight appears, there's a spike in gamma rhythm. It's as if Insight had gone incandescent. And they could trace the activity to a small part of the right brain. The prevailing wisdom is that the left brain is more important, the conscious brain that controls language. The right brain is sometimes seen as minor. It seems more vague and unknown. The right brain is the creative side, which is great, but non-essential, as the old cliched brain science has it. Modern brain science has found that this is overly simplistic. The hemispheres are deeply connected and interdependent. But in terms of Insight, the old clichés hold water. Lehrer describes Insight as a balancing act. At first, the brain lavishes the scarce resource of attention on a single problem. But once the brain is sufficiently focused, the cortex needs to relax in order to seek out the more remote association in the right hemisphere, which will provide the insight. Lehrer quotes one of the scientists who says, "That's why so many insights happen during warm showers. You have to relax away from your left brain. You have to cast your net wide over all of your knowledge. It's why, as a writer, I keep a notebook by the bed. Often, in a half-asleep state, my mind will see the connections I'm looking for. You can't focus too hard." One of the surprising lessons of this research is that trying to force an insight can actually prevent the insight. Concentration comes with the hidden cost of diminished creativity. This was all reminding me very strongly of a conversation I'd had with Greg Jackson. Sitting one afternoon in Greg's quiet office between classes, I asked him about the martial arts from those dark times in human history, traditional arts, fighting styles and systems that had been discredited in the MMA ring. Greg had responded, "Those were created to deal with a certain problem at a certain time and a certain place. It's not that it doesn't work. It does work against samurai. These guys weren't idiots, and it was a tough time. Our stuff is the pinnacle of unarmed personal combat. We're in the process as it keeps evolving. It's hyper-specialized. We don't have to deal with weapons, or arrows, or horseback. When you think about it, I'm pretty sure in a battle during the Crusades or in medieval Japan, you'd never want to leave your feet. You probably wouldn't shoot a takedown and work top position surrounded by guys with spears and swords. Leaving your feet would be death." This was when Greg recommended I read Zen in the Art of Archery. "I use that all the time when I teach," he said, "but I say it's like walking to the door. When you get up and walk to the door, you don't think about it. You don't put this foot in front of that foot and think your way through it. You just walk, without thinking. That's how fighting should be. The door is a metaphor for your opponent. Don't think about how you get there, just get there. And when you do that, you do things that are good. You hit somebody with something that you didn't even know you were going to throw. And he didn't expect it either, because you weren't thinking about it. That's when it really happens, what Musashi calls the void." I didn't get it. Greg laughed. He was aware of the trickiness of the concept. "You have to be calm enough to get to the void. It's that weird fucking concept. Here's my problem with Eastern teaching. They're talking about experience, but they can't say experience. For some reason, they won't say it. So they say, unlearn what you have learned. Which you can understand when you're on the other side of it, but what a terrible way to teach it. It's stupid. Zen's job is to break that filter down and get you to experience everything, to get that logic filter out of your brain. So I can see why they say it, but it's much easier if someone told me in Western language, because we live in the Western culture. I understand that it's really cool to say, unlearn what you have learned, but teach in the culture you're in. So I prefer, find that place where you don't think about putting one foot in front of the other when you go to the door." I thought about my own experience in sparring, and of the right hand. I fight orthodox, which means my left hand is the lead and jabs, and my right is the power punch. I could land the jab okay, but whenever I threw the right hand, it seemed like it was too late. Because I had to think about it, plan for it. When I started doing drills with Javier, I started throwing it all the time. And then, in sparring, I would just throw it. Don't think about it. Just throw it. and lo and behold, it was landing. That's why the mental toughness conditioning is important. As you get kicked or hit, and it starts to hurt, it forces you to focus on yourself instead of what you should be thinking about. It breaks you out of the place you want to be in, not the void. That made sense. I asked Greg about the spiritual side of fighting. Did he think there were a lot of things in the traditional martial arts that were good for MMA? The problem is, the traditional guys are holding on to their outmoded techniques. They've been doing reverse punches for 25 years. You're going to come and tell them that they wasted their time? But all those traditionalists maintain the spirituality of what they do is tied to their art, that there's no separation between the two. But it's these jerks that have intertwined Zen and their old techniques. And so you say, oh, it's all bullshit, it doesn't work. It's no one's fault but the guys who won't let it go. I think we'll come back to it. Someday we'll say, oh, these guys practiced for 2,000 years, and they weren't stupid. There are lessons there. I'm not going to war with a musket, but the lessons can be learned. It's the same bullet, but a different gun. We've all heard of the zone, that heightened mental state in which we perform perfectly. I think I first heard it in discussion of basketball players, who would get hot and sink 10 shots in a row, feeling it and in the zone. Probably in those old interviews with Michael Jordan when he would pin 50 points on the Knicks. It's a kind of relaxed supercompetence, a place where you aren't nervous and make every shot, every right decision. You had it in post-game interviews. I was in the zone, the athlete would say. That explained it. A professor at the University of Chicago named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, Csikszentmihalyi, I think, wrote the definitive book of the zone, though he called it the flow. Csikszentmihalyi gathered up 25 years of research and interviews and evidence for his 1990 book, Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. And the concept began to work its way into popular discussion, ESPN analysis, and sports radio. I feel there is some connection here between the zone, the Eureka hunt, and the void that Greg was talking about. Being in the groove, that athletic place of peak performance, when the hitter can see the stitches on the baseball, when time slows down for a fighter, and the left hook materializes out of nowhere and connects. It all seems related, these flashes of deeper understanding. It's almost like using the Force from the Star Wars movies. But this is relaxing and letting go into muscle memory and action. Obi-Wan says, "The Force flows through you." We talk about it all the time in sports, even playing pool at the local bar. You'll run the table and laugh about being in the zone. The balls are just falling. Josh Waitzkin wrote about it in his Art of Learning, about building triggers to more easily fall into that state of easy attunedness. There's a chapter every fighter and trainer should read, about creating rituals to stay calm and clear before a fight. It reminded me of what Mark Delagrotti intuitively understood. The fighter needs to feel relaxed and confident. His energy's brought to bear on only one thing. I got in touch with Jonah Lehrer in Boston and asked him about a connection between his article on insight and the zone. He wanted to clarify a few things. Not the right brain per se. There is a lot of pop science out there about the right brain-left brain split, and the insight circuit is very interesting to me because it conforms to this cliche we have about the right brain being more intuitive and artistic and all the rest, but in general, the right brain is not necessarily always better at unconscious intuitive thought. Not right brain, but the emotional brain, I think, is a better way to say it. Not just on the right side. When you talk about how athletes are thinking and the importance of not overthinking what you're doing, it's less about relying on the right brain than it is turning off the prefrontal cortex, the rational circuit behind your eyes, and relying more on the emotional brain. The intuitive, instinctive, emotional brain. For a baseball player, how you hit a fastball going 95 miles an hour seems impossible, technically. The brain shouldn't be able to react that fast. You add up the time it takes from when the ball leaves the pitcher's hand to when the batter swings. Technically, you can't move that fast. Yet obviously, batters hit fastballs. So batters begin their swing before the ball is released. So they're relying on implicit unconscious cues, signals they're not close to aware of, body language, torque on wrist. Hitters pick up on that in non-conscious, all-implicit ways. If they think too much, it becomes paralyzing. Think about it this way. The emotional unconscious brain, the primitive brain we share with other animals, has been perfected by evolution for the last 200 million years. It's like a very efficient supercomputer with all the bugs worked out. And then, we've got the rational prefrontal cortex, which is 10 million years old, so it's relatively new. It's like software version 1.0. It has bugs and makes mistakes. It's what lets us do algebra and reflect, and what makes us uniquely human. But it's small, and you don't want to rely on it for complex movement. I started reading one of the sports psychology textbooks, Applied Sports Psychology, edited by Gene M. Williams. The guys at the Army Center for Enhanced Performance had told me to read it as a primer. Poring over it, I thought to myself, geez, this is all really obvious. Athletes that think more positively do better. Duh. And it is. Sports psychology is fairly simple and self-explanatory. But the important thing to do is to realize it is obvious and make use of it. The conscious mind is simpler than you think. If you direct it, you can get better results. That's the basis of sports psychology. There's not a great mystery. The strategies are simple, but labor-intensive. Make detailed lists of goals, not only in the short term, but in the long. Enhance positive thinking with positive imagery. Like Randy Couture, don't think in negatives. Give yourself positive stuff to work for. Not don't give up the takedown, but get that underhook. Basically, take and develop the habits that successful top-flight athletes use. I dug through the textbook for the peak performance chapters. The researchers take the experience of the zone, or whatever you want to call it, and quantify it through hard work and statistical analysis of athletes' responses. Although many athletes describe this euphoric feeling as involuntary, there is consensus among sports psychologists that this state can be achieved more often through analysis. Certainly elite athletes get there more often. When applied sports psychology describes peak performance, here are the notes it hits. Loss of fear, no fear of failure. No thinking of performance. Total immersion in activity. Narrow focus of attention. Effortless performance, not forcing it. Feeling of being in complete control. Time-space disorientation, usually slowed down. Universe perceived to be integrated and unified. Unique, temporary, involuntary experience. These were common experiences described and collated by psychologists studying thousands and thousands of athletes, bringing together many studies. When I read through some of the literature on the zone and peak performance, and started to get a feel for what these athletes were going through, that line about the universe perceived to be integrated and unified caught my eye. That was some hippy-dippy shit right there. That was some hippy-dippy shit right there. Come on. Really? The universe is unified? In a textbook? It sounds like Eastern mysticism. Flow like a river, touching the leaf, step by step I quiet the babbling brook. It occurred to me that what is Zen in martial arts, but an earlier, more exhaustive study of sports psychology. Sports psychology, as a genuine field of study, has existed for only 20 or 30 years. Musashi represents a tradition of study that covers hundreds of years, if not millennia. Greg Jackson's depiction of the void sounded suspiciously like getting in the zone to me, and so I reread Musashi and some others, Zen and the Art of Archery, recommended by both Henzo and Greg Jackson, and The Life-Giving Sword by a contemporary of Musashi's, Yagyu Munenori. Here were writers and practitioners who had devoted lifetimes of study to problems that their caste had already devoted hundreds of years of study to, tested in actual combat, to the death. The reason Zen and that Eastern philosophy is often poo-pooed by fighters is that it sounds like bullshit. Pat Miletich had a fighter who studied Musashi, and Pat thought that was his biggest problem. Too much thinking. The Western reader pretends there may be shortcuts to mastery, mysterious shortcuts. There's the Karate Kid idea. A few months of study, a few words of wisdom, and you can beat a black belt. Even the recent kids flick Kung Fu Panda had the hero realize the secret.